You're listening to the Book Talk Today podcast, a podcast that inspires readers to obtain valuable insights to inform, educate, and improve lives. My name is Orhan Abdi. I'm an avid reader, best known for the creation of the 1 Minute Book Review community, and I'm sitting down with authors to delve deeper into the books they have written to uncover the story behind the story. Hello, Book Talk Today family, and welcome back to another episode of the Book Talk Today podcast. My name is Orhan, I am your host, and in today's podcast, we are joined by Ian Stewart. Ian is an emeritus professor in the mathematics department at Warwick University, where he divides time equally between research into non-linear dynamics and furthering public awareness of mathematics. He has published more than 120 books. Yes, you've heard that correctly, 120 books on a range of different topics, including mathematics and fantasy fiction. Ian and I had a great conversation around mathematics, but also some of the relationship between mathematics and writing fiction, particularly. That might not be something that you can see similarities between, but in our conversation, we talked about some of the mindsets that is needed to be a mathematician, but also to write fiction. The premise of our conversation was based on his most recent book, which is What's the Use? The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics. This book right here with a very funky cover, actually. One of my favorite covers I've seen so far. So props to you, Ian, on the cover. Like I said, the conversation was interesting. We didn't delve too deeply into the technical aspects of mathematics because I am not well versed in that. But it was a very, very interesting conversation that I look forward to sharing with you. If you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast. Every single week we release a podcast with an author where we discuss their books and the ideas and principles inside of it. Subscribing to our YouTube channel is the best way to do that. So head over if you're listening to this on Apple or Spotify and head over to our YouTube channel at Book Talk Today. Without further ado, here is the podcast with Ian. Ian, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. And after reading your story on your website and reading your book on mathematics, I was fascinated because here's me picking up your book and reading it, thinking that I'm going to just get a maths professor. And I have a look at your bio and it turns out that you've published 120 books on sci-fi to academic papers and mathematics. And I was utterly fascinated that I shared even with my whole family, thinking here's this sci-fi writer and mathematician. So I really wanted to know sort of where your fascination with science fiction writing and mathematics really started and whether you see any parallels between the both of them.
Okay, it started reasonably early. I mean, even in when I was about five or six, the math classes in school were interesting, and with one exception, I could handle them pretty well. The one exception was we had a test and I added all the numbers and I should have subtracted them. So I got zero marks, and this counted against me for a while until my mother sorted it all out. Went round the school and argued with them. But probably around about the ages of 14 or 15 was when both the science fiction interest and more serious interest in the math started up. I guess this is not unusual, actually. Sort of early teenage years, you start to get into particular things which then grab your attention and carry on for the rest of your life. So the math, I started reading Martin Gardner's very famous column in Scientific American. So there's an American journalist called Martin Gardner, wasn't a mathematician, but for years and years he had a fascinating mathematical games column in Scientific American magazine. And he was a brilliant expositor. He made everything seem interesting and simple. And although it's called mathematical games, there was often a quite serious mathematical idea behind whatever he was explaining. So I read that, and the message I got from that, which I wasn't getting from school, was there's an awful lot of math out there. It's new. There's new stuff coming all the time. You can actually invent new mathematics for yourself. I thought, well, that's a cool idea. I quite enjoy doing that. And I had a couple of friends who were similarly inclined, and we were doing little bits of mathematical investigations of our own, just for the fun of it. Sounds a bit sad to most people, I suspect, but we really enjoyed doing this. So for example, once we came up with an idea that suppose you have five dice, and you toss them and you keep going till whenever a six turns up, you take it out. You keep going until all five have come up as six. How long on average does it take to get all five of them coming out for six? And what's the probability distribution? And we calculated this theoretically. And then we did this experiment, tossing them up to 50 or more times in order to get all five sixes. We did it 10,000 times for weeks in my friend's room. We had a huge piece of graph paper and we glued extra bits on the bottom. And we were delighted to find that our theoretical result matched the experiment pretty well. Really? So that was fun. The science fiction, it was the same group of kids. We were kind of into that and went down to the local secondhand bookshop and picked up any science fiction books we could get. And one of my friends, his name was John Hart, he and I had a kind of informal competition to see who could get the biggest collection. And we were about equal, but then he went off to London, where there are lots of very good secondhand bookshops, and he was way ahead of me after that. But I think I've caught up now, because last time I counted, there were 9,000 science fiction books and magazines in and around the house. There's a lot of books in our house.
That's quite the collection you have there, 9,000.
Yeah, well, you know, this is sort of 60 years plus of collecting and hoarding.
It's interesting, though, because people think that you're either into mathematics or you're into literature or writing. You know, when we're at school, people like to think, you know, you're either a mathematician mind, you either have a maths mind, or you either have like an English literature mind. So do you think that's sort of a overthought process and you don't actually think that's true?
I think it may be true in a broad scale. In other words, if you took 100 people, you would find that you know, maybe 40 of them are very, very much literary minded, and 40 of them are technically minded, with mathematics somewhere on the harder end of the technical. Although I find computer science much harder than math, I'll tell you that.
Why is that?
Because there's so much detail. If you want to actually make a computer work, do programming, that kind of thing, I can do it up to a certain amateur level, and I can kind of make the computers I'm using work, and I use them in research, and I can write a certain amount of software. But I always feel that an expert would do all of this much more quickly, far better, and actually understand what they were doing. Whereas in math, I kind of feel that most of the time I understand what I'm trying to do. But if it's research, math research consists largely of beating your head against a brick wall saying, I don't understand this stuff. It's not working. What the heck's going on? And every so often, idea, something worked.
You get the light bulb come through.
Yeah, and it's the light bulb moment that you cherish. That's what makes it all worthwhile. I think probably there are a certain number of people, a proportion that, 10-15%, who are fairly at home in both worlds. I mean, they're kind of artistic and scientific. They can understand.
They're sort of creative, aren't they?
Yeah, they're sort of creative in the artistic sense, but also math can be very creative, but it's a creativity that you probably have to be a mathematician to really appreciate, because it's too easy to... The technical details mask the creativity. Yeah, I mean, if you've got five pages of calculations, any five pages of calculations look much the same as any other five pages of calculations, but some are just routine, straightforward stuff. You just have to bash your way through it. And some of it, there's a really clever idea in there. You think, hey, yeah, and I like that. So, you know, I can sort of do that.
How do you go about creating your own type of maths? Earlier on, you said, you know, you can even invent your own type of maths.
Yeah.
How do you go about doing that?
The way we did it when I was a kid, and to some extent the way everyone does it, is firstly, you have to have actually read a certain amount and understood a certain amount, so you've got somewhere to build from. But then you start looking at the stuff you know and tweaking it and saying, what happens if I've just learnt at school how to solve quadratic equations, you know, with x squared in them. Well, for a long time, the mathematicians of the world could not do the next rather obvious step. What if it's an x cubed instead of an x squared? What about cubic equations? And there's some wonderful history from Renaissance Italy, which is fascinating historically because it's, I mean, they're fighting duels and it's really, you could make a wonderful movie of some of this. Someone's done a nice book, actually, where the mathematicians are actually publicly battling with each other, solving cubic equations. Mathematical duel. But it's sometimes just a matter of saying, okay, now we know a certain standard thing. Pythagoras' theorem, right angled triangle, there's a formula, the sums of the squares and so on. What if it's not right angled? What happens then? Is there something like it for four-sided figures instead of triangles? You know, how far does this stuff go? Now, the really top-level research mathematicians, firstly, they have this huge database of mathematics in their heads. They're really on top of a lot of stuff. And they tend to make progress by noticing a connection between two different branches of mathematics that nobody had noticed existed before. And then, okay, well, now if one area is connected to a new area I didn't think about, can the new area give me insights into the old area that I wouldn't get if I just stayed within that realm? Yeah. If you've got two different ways of thinking about the problem, together they may be much more powerful than either of them on their own. So it's to some extent that. Then, of course, there are lots and lots of standard problems float around the community that people want to know about. And there's now online forums where you can post your questions. Like, does anybody know anything about such and such problem? And if you're lucky, somebody you've never heard of in some part of the world you may never have visited says, yeah, I know about that. Why don't you try this? You know, and 10 times out of, well, 9 times out of 10 doesn't get anywhere, but the 10th time, big breakthrough. Yeah, that's the way to do it. So one of the things people outside math don't probably realize is there's a worldwide mathematical community. They know each other. They work together. We don't know everybody, but you know, you have a network of people in lots of different countries, lots of different universities, mostly working in your area, but then they have friends who work in different areas, and so you get to know people in other ones. And it kind of works like that.
Do you find in the global network that individuals from different countries and cultures approach it in different ways?
To some extent, yes, although math is very much universal. The underlying language and the symbols and the theorems and the basic stuff is very similar. But I think people in different countries, you come from a different cultural background, and the cultural background can't really affect what mathematics is true and what mathematics is false and which ideas work and which don't. But it can affect which ideas you get and which problems you find interesting. And I mean, for example, people from a developing country, interestingly enough, you would expect them to be focused on the more practical aspects of mathematics, because that's what's important for their country and it's what their government wants them to do math for and so on. And a lot of them are. But you will also get some who just love it for its internal beauty. And they can sometimes, my first PhD student was from Ghana. He was African. And he was amazing because his background in the subject had to be much less than a typical Western person, because he wouldn't have done all the courses at university that we would expect to do. And he would go down to the library. If there was something that came up he didn't understand, you know, some area he'd not studied before that came up in the work he was doing, he'd go down to the library, get a book out on it, spend about 3 days reading the book from start to finish, and then he knew the area. He picked up, oh, wow. From that point on, you would never know he'd not taken a course in it. And often on problems, he was quicker to see how to solve it than I was. So we had a very fruitful collaboration, but I was extraordinarily impressed. But I think there was something in the cultural background that gave him a slightly different view of things.
It just seemed like he had a flavour for it.
He had a flavour, yeah. He was, unfortunately, he ended up, well, from my point of view, unfortunately, he ended up working for a bank in Chicago. and stopped doing research math. In fact, I changed my field of research fairly soon after that because, among other things, I'd lost the person that I mostly worked with. And a lot of mathematicians, it's much more collaborative nowadays. It used to be the sort of lone genius working in the attic, works for years and then comes up with a wonderful solution to something. You publish it and then you go back and start doing that again. It's always a bit of a caricature, but if you look at authorship of research papers, they're mostly single author. Until you get to about 1970, 1980, and then you start to get little groups of people collaborating, and they can get bigger. I'm currently working with a group in New York, and there's 10 of us involved in the project. And you know, some are in Brazil, some are in America, I'm over here, all over the place. I wrote a 5-author paper a while ago with one person from New Zealand, one from India, one from Japan, one from America, and me from United Kingdom. And it was mostly done by Zoom, Skype, and emails.
Email, yeah.
But from time to time, we get together.
why do you think it moved from single person to sort of groups in that period that you said? What was one of the reasons why that happened?
One reason was that there was a lot of pressure on the pure mathematicians to start getting more involved in applications. Because if you look at pure math in the abstract, it's not at all clear what it's useful for. History shows that a lot of it turns out to be useful later on. Yeah, I think things that Gauss invented in the 1850s turn out to be fantastic for computer code cryptography. The whole of number theory from the 19th century is now 21st century cutting edge computer security. Things like that happen, but it takes 100 years or so, or it can do. Well, the math community in general felt that this link was not being appreciated. So I think there was internal and external pressure to get more involved in areas outside your own particular little niche. Once you start doing that, you need people who are experts in the application, but you then find that you need different areas of math from the one you're familiar with to work together on it. So the problem throws up new aspects where you suddenly think, we need a different mathematician here. And then as a result of that, you start to get these collaborations forming. I think another one is, it got much easier to travel in the 1960s, 70s, 80s. Air travel was much easier, got cheaper and cheaper. You could go to conferences, you could meet people. And if you meet people, you start to, you sit talking and somebody says something, oh, now that's an interesting problem. I can imagine working on that. And well, okay, let's see what we can do. So I think that's another reason. I think the problems in many ways are getting, in certain ways, they get harder and you just need more people to understand them properly. So it's a mixture of things. But it definitely there is this trend towards, I mean, a typical mathematical collaboration might be 2 or 3. That's no longer unusual. 5 or 6 is possible, but it would have to be a particular kind of problem for that to happen. The 10-author collaboration I'm in is a mixture of math and biology and physics, and we've got mathematicians, biologists and physicists, kind of 3 and a bit of each, roughly speaking. So that it's the nature of the problem that led to this large group. You know.
And when you research, are these self-funded projects or are these projects funded by others?
Okay. Increasingly, for most academic mathematicians, they are funded by government research grant, NSF, something like that in the States, or a private foundation. In Europe, the European Union funds a lot of research. Of course, Britain has just decided to move out of the European Union, which has caused enormous problems for everyone who was involved with it. You know, there are lots of sources of funding, but a certain amount of math you can do. You don't need a lot of equipment. You need Well, the old joke used to be that for philosophy you need pencil and paper, and for math you need pencil, paper and wastebasket. And to some extent that's still true. You know, a lot of math can be done with pencil and paper, but I use a certain amount of computational stuff. But I mean, I use my own computer at home. I don't use university equipment. It didn't cost that much. It wasn't cheap, but it was, you know, entirely reasonable. And increasingly, the equipment mathematicians need is a lot cheaper, easier to get. One of the big problems for funding now is publication charges. When you publish your paper in a journal, the old model was, well, the journal sold, they sold the journal, made a profit, and that paid the cost of the publisher. Well, now we're going to open access publishing. You want everyone to be able to read the paper free. Well, someone's got to pay for it. And the usual way someone pays for it is somebody's research grant pays the publication costs. Well, I don't have a research grant. See, I retired 13 years ago. And if you're retired, then you don't have access to the kind of funding that you might get. So one of the ways I deal with that is collaborate with people who've got the funding to pay for the publication.
Yes.
One way is to find a journal that allows me to publish without charging fees. Occasionally, the journal will waive the fees for people in this position. So it's not a big problem, but it's slightly changed the funding model.
How has the technology, the changes in technology really over the last 30, 40 years changed your approach to how you do your research and how you do your calculations and this type of stuff?
I think across the board, in a lot of areas, in pure and applied mathematics, the computers are used much more as a kind of experimental tool. You can, if I'm trying to solve an equation or something, I can simulate it on the computer, do hundreds and hundreds of examples and see if I can spot a pattern. You couldn't do that when you're doing it by hand. There are whole areas of research where without the computer, it's just got too complicated and you can't do it. On the other hand, there are other mathematicians who really just don't want to use computers at all, maybe for email, but you know, not too much more. Yeah. They prefer still to use the little grey cells in their brain. It's the combination of the two that actually makes everything work nowadays. So even if I'm working on a problem that does not involve computation, I may be basing some of the work on research papers by other people who have used computers, who've come up with interesting examples, conjectures, that is, problems where you can guess what the answer can be, but you can't prove it, that kind of thing. So computers are coming in more and more. There used to be a semi-philosophical debate about whether it was legitimate to use a computer to prove a theorem. The classic example, there's a thing called the four-color theorem, which is very easy to state. Take a map, just a sort of random map of lots of countries adjacent to each other. Way back, somebody noticed that if you've got four different colours of pencils, you know, red, yellow, green, blue, you can colour the map so that no two countries that share a border have the same colour. If you've only got three colours of pencil, there are maps that you can't colour in that way. But you never seem to need five. Now, for a long period of time, it was known that if you have five colours, you could colour every map. And if you had three, you couldn't. And everyone believed the answer was four, but they couldn't close this gap between four and five. Now, eventually, it was proved that four colours are enough. The calculation at that time took 2,000 hours on the fastest computer around. It would probably take 10 minutes now, if not 5 seconds. But they had to, basically, that they had, there was some clever math done in pencil and paper and in the brain, which reduced the whole thing to, here is a list of 2,000 different maps. For each one of these, you have to do a calculation that establishes some interesting property of this map. The property is basically, if you think it needs five colours, actually you can tinker around with it and get rid of one of the colours. So then you just have to check each map of this list of 2,000. The problem was doing that by hand was a huge, huge difficult calculation, lots and lots of cases to check for each map. So they did it on computer. And the computer said, yep, yep, it works. And then everyone said, okay, well, we know it's true, assuming the computer hasn't made a mistake or the programmer hasn't got it wrong. But it's not very satisfactory when the proof is stick it on the computer, here's the program, here's how it works, wait several days, and out comes the answer, yep, that's right. Is that a proof? Well, nowadays, firstly, we've got used to this. Secondly, a lot of people say, look, basically, I believe the computer more than I do the person with pencil and paper.
Yeah.
Yes, I want to check the program and make sure there's no mistakes in the programming. Some people go as far as saying, I want to check the computer operating system to make sure that it is actually doing what we think it will do. And one mathematician found a mistake in the Pentium chip, an actual error in the structure of the chip, which meant it got some of its sums wrong. You can find all this online. He was trying to, he was looking at a very sophisticated number theory problem in mathematics, problem about whole numbers, and doing experiments on the computer. And sometimes the computer experiments just didn't seem to fit what he thought ought to be happening. And he tracked it down and found that it wasn't a problem with the math. It was a problem with the chip.
So did he find that out by changing the chip?
He discovered by experimenting, he discovered that if you gave the chip a particular multiplication sum, the kind that you could get at school, a long multiplication, I mean, a 1029 times 353 or whatever, it got the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Which means clearly there's something wrong in the arithmetic part of the chip. And I think then the engineers tracked down what had gone wrong. I think four lines of code had been lost when they were designing the chip. So a little bit of chip didn't get built.
That's not ideal. No.
So there's this interesting interplay between computers and math now, and there's all sorts of interesting mathematical problems come out of computation, and computers are great for helping solve your math problem. But we're kind of getting used to it because everyone's grown up with it. And there's also very good computer verification systems. So if you have a computer proof, you can get a computer to verify the proof. Now, that may seem like it's not a big step forward because who verifies the verifying computer? But the software for doing the verification is fairly straightforward. You can check by hand that it's been written correctly. So you have a program that you trust because you understand exactly how it works, but then you let it loose on some very complicated calculation. But computers are so reliable nowadays that you pretty much believe the calculation. If you don't, run it on three different computers by three different manufacturers with different operating systems. If they all give the same answer and you can kind of cross-check the details, it's got to be right.
Yeah, it's got to be right after doing all those checks.
There may be this deep philosophical view that a mathematical proof has to be checkably correct every single step by anybody. But in practice, nobody ever does that anyway. In practice, when you're reading a research paper, you think, do I believe this? Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, hang on. There's always a problem in with this kind of argument. You have to be very careful not to make a certain mistake. Have they made that mistake? No, they haven't. It's all right. So it's that kind of thing. Does the story convince me? Proof is a story. You know, given a right-angled triangle, you know, Ridgy, the right-angled triangle, went out one day and measured his hypotenuse, and he ended up discovering, oh, look, the sum of the squares on the other two sides is the square on my hypotenuse. It's kind of like a story. And the proof is a story. It said, well, we start from these hypotheses, right-angled triangle, and then we bring in these various other characters who are theorems we've proved already. Here's one I made earlier. You put it all together and here's how it works. And look, lo and behold, at the end, you get Pythagoras' theorem. Isn't that amazing? I wrote a paper once called, which is essentially saying a proof is not a sequence of logical steps, each following from the other. That's like saying a symphony is a sequence of musical notes, each following from the other. No, it's not. It's what it sounds like when you listen to it. A proof is the story it tells when you read it. So proofs are about stories.
Do you think it's about feeling as well in that sense? Because you say that if someone's satisfied or the person who's doing it is satisfied with the result.
It's actually very emotional. And if you work in an area for a while, it's a bit dangerous, but you get a feeling for how things fit together. And if somebody's saying something that doesn't make sense, your immediate reaction is, I don't think I believe that. Not saying you're wrong, but I don't see how that goes. You know, that's either fantastically interesting because it's different from what I expected, or there's a mistake. And I haven't even looked at any of the details you've written down when I make that judgment. If you have two mathematicians trying to solve some problem, we usually do it at a blackboard with chalk still. It's great because you can rub the chalk out again. You get covered in chalk dust, but that's how it is.
It's part of the game.
Yeah, the Mathematics Institute at Warwick University, where I worked for a long time and still go fairly often, has big blackboards all over the place and supplies of chalk. Shouldn't you be up to modern technology? Well, for what we want, this is the modern technology. This works best. But anyway, if two mathematicians are trying to solve a problem, you will get quite heated arguments between them. I mean, my wife, who's not a mathematician, has listened to some of this stuff and it feels like they're about to go at each other's throats. And then suddenly one of them will say, oh, that's what you meant. Oh, I see. Sorry, I completely misunderstood that point. Yes, of course. Yes, you're right. You know, I wish politicians would be the same. You can have the fight.
If only.
And you have to be emotionally invested in the problem or you will not put in the effort to solve it. Because it's such a pain, actually. I mean, I've got a problem I've been working on now for 13, 14 years. It was blindingly obvious at the beginning that it must be true. It's still obvious it must be true. In the middle, somebody proved it, but then it turned out there was a mistake. And the proof still works for a lot of cases, but it doesn't work for everything. And I've just put together a paper saying, if you add a few extra conditions, I can now prove it. But I've still got this problem rattling around in my head because it's not been solved and it ought to be obvious.
How do you, over all those 13 years, how do you change your approach? Is it about going back to the first principles or is it about seeing if there's any other patterns from things that you've solved in the past and try to apply it to
it? It's mostly the second one. It's trying to find another way of thinking about it. To some extent, it's, I'm fed up with this. I'll put it, and you stuff it in the filing cabinet for 3 years. And then one morning you wake up and think, hang on. Suppose I didn't do so-and-so, suppose I did something else. Is there some other way of doing this? And occasionally those ideas work. So you pick it up again and have another go. And occasionally somebody else comes along and says, no, that's not how you do it. It's a totally different way of handling that problem. Because they know some math background that they think applies that you don't know.
Yep.
Yeah, and again, often that can lead to a collaboration. It depends, you know, have they solved the whole thing already? Well, then they write the paper. Have they got partway and then got stuck? Maybe I can help them. Let's discuss this. Yeah, so that's sort of how it goes. But it is quite emotional.
Yeah, I can imagine. What's your approach to actually writing science fiction? Then we've talked about your sort of maths approach, but what's your approach to actually writing science fiction? Like, how do you go about the story writing? Do you apply any of the things that you've learned from your mathematics approach into your writing? So how do you just approach the whole endeavor?
Okay, I have a strong feeling, which may just be it's all residing in my head, that the different kinds of writing and the different things I'm interested in all sort of fit together into some kind of rather vague structure. So certainly ideas from the maths can feed through into the science fiction. I recently had an email from a woman in Germany who writes lots and lots of science fiction short stories in German, mostly based on research papers she's read somewhere. And she got hold of one of my books. She got in search. I've just had 20 science fiction story ideas from your book.
Wow.
You know, and I'm thinking, that's interesting because I wrote the book and I didn't see any. And I've read some of her. I can read German well enough just about to get along. And I've read some of the stories. And yep, there's math ideas in there which really drive the story. It's very interesting. What I found, I got into writing science fiction through writing, popularizing math. So in the United States is a very famous science fiction magazine called Analog. It used to be called Astounding. It still exists. And I was in Connecticut for a year doing mathematics at the university. And Ben Bover, who was the editor of Analog, lived in Hartford, Connecticut, about 30 miles away. And I and a friend had written a piece on topology for Analog because they had a science fact column section, you know, about 10 pages of science fact, not fiction. And he quite liked that. And he invited us over one evening when it was published. My wife and I went over. And while we were there, he said, why don't you try writing science fiction? Write a short story. So I thought, well, I sort of thought about doing it, but never really had a good idea. He said, well, you know, think about it. So we went back, and a few days later, my wife came in with a big box full of bits and pieces of a typewriter, which she had found and bought for $5 in the flea market. And it was about 1920s typewriter in pieces. And she said, right, here's something to do over the winter. Fit this together, make it work. So I did, and it turned out all the pieces were there, and it even had a ribbon which still had ink that would write. Wow. So I sat down at this thing. I better write something on this. And a science fiction idea popped into my head. And I basically just sat down and wrote out the whole thing over a few days. Sent it to Ben Bover saying, OK, Ben, tell me what's wrong with it and I'll rewrite. What he sent back was a check.
Oh, wow.
He bought it.
Were you surprised?
I was absolutely gobsmacked, as they say. I was flabbergasted. I just did not expect this. I then discovered it's much more difficult to sell the second story. But I carried on doing this for a while. And then in recent years, I've got into writing science fiction novels, largely with two friends. Both of whom have died in the last few years, but they're for a long time we collaborated on. One was a biologist, one was another mathematician, and we would plan out, for the fun of it, we planned out a science fiction novel. In fact, I got started on that because my biologist friend and I were travelling to do a radio programme 5 hours' drive away. So we were going down, doing the programme, staying overnight at a hotel, coming back. And it's a long, boring drive down the motorway. And on the way, we started planning out some sort of science fiction story. And this really got me. I think it started with my biologist friend saying, can you think of a good reason why wheeled organisms might exist? Plenty of organisms with legs, but how could you evolve wheels? And then we said, well, maybe you can't do it directly, but maybe there's an indirect method whereby some other creature could actually construct quasi-living organisms which have wheels. And we carried on and on with this, and we decided it happened in floating cities on Jupiter. And there was something that had happened on Europa, one of the satellites, and one of these wheeled creatures was buried in the ice. And the whole thing just got more and more complicated from there. And by the time we got to the hotel, we had the entire plot planned out. And before we forgot it, I sat down with a pile of hotel stationery and sketched it all out. And then my friend Jack, the biologist, he was in science fiction quite a lot as a fan and advising major science fiction writers on biological aspects of their stories. And he had an agent for this. So we sent the outline of this book to the agent, who promptly sold it. So then we had to write it.
You had to write it, yeah.
Yeah. And we had great fun writing this thing. It's called Wheelers. It starts with somebody discovering that the moons of Jupiter have moved.
Okay.
They're not in the place they should be. and we have a slightly convoluted way of making this discovery known. Because the astronomers aren't bothering to observe Jupiter much, because everyone knows how the moons move.
Similar to the maths approach, in the sense that you said earlier that, you know, there's established ways of thinking, but no one perhaps might look beneath the surface to actually look at something that is established.
That's right. Put it so the key idea that starts it and gives it the title is wheeled aliens. And you could just wave your hands and say, oh, look, there's these creatures on such and such a planet that have got wheels. In fact, there are science fiction stories like that. But my friend Jack, his whole point when he was advising science fiction writers was the biology has to be plausible. It has to make sense. It has to make evolutionary sense. It has to make ecological sense. Organisms don't just appear. He went around schools giving a talk, which was called What Does a Martian Look Like?
Okay.
Which always started saying, yeah. And he started by saying, people always ask, you know, if humans grew up on Mars, what would they look like? Wrong question. Humans didn't grow up on Mars. If things evolved on Mars, they wouldn't be humans. Mm. We could still ask what they might look like. But, you know, what do Earth creatures look like? Well, which one are you talking about?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. You know, do you mean a human being? Do you mean a cat? Do you mean a bacterium? These are all Earth organisms. Mm. Deep down inside, it turns out they're all related by DNA and evolution. That's not obvious when you look at them. Yeah. So you should approach the whole problem of alien life from a different point of view. What are the conditions on the planet? How might evolution go? What sort of ingredients are there for living creatures? Would they be like us? Would they be totally different from us?
Did he pose the question, or did he actually come up with sort of an idea?
He came up with some ideas. Yeah, he and I wrote a book, which actually it ended up called What Does a Martian Look Like? The original title was Evolving the Alien, and it exists with both titles. And it was our approach to life on other planets, based on the idea that the really interesting life forms, if they exist and nobody knows, would be very different from what happens here. You know, you need water, you need oxygen, you need carbon. Maybe you don't. Mm. What happens on a planet that hasn't got those? But could there be some kind of life form that would still work? So we had things like silicon flakes with electronic circuitry living in pools of minerals on some planet that hasn't got an atmosphere. And they reproduce by essentially copying the circuits from one flake. The flake lands on a rock, its circuit gets diffused over, then it splits off, and now you've got two flakes. And if they make mistakes in copying the circuits, they evolve. Mm. You know, and you can come up with wonderful, I mean, there's no reason any of this should actually happen. Yeah. It maybe we're the only life form in the, you know, only planet in the universe with life. It's the only one we know about, but we haven't really looked very far because we can't. We will see.
Did he have an actual idea about that? What was his thought on actually extraterrestrial life? What did he say the chances were?
Okay. Jack's view was, the chance of it being, there has to be fairly advanced life forms. There have to be fairly advanced life forms all over the place, because there's a huge number of stars. Even in one galaxy, you've got maybe 400 billion stars. Most stars are now known to have planets. Planets have moons. You can get life on any of the planets or the moons. Well, not on any of them, but you know, potentially that's where you'd look for them. It would be very surprising if only one world out of all of that lot had life. Mm. On the other hand, you can imagine it's a pretty rare thing to get all the necessary bits and pieces together. But you don't have to assume they are the identical bits and pieces to what happened on this planet. Because if you do that, then you're making the mistake of assuming there's only one way for these things to happen. This is what happened here. You know, and I can prove to you that you can't possibly exist. I just ask, you know, what's your telephone number? What's the registration number of your car? You know, social security number, so on. You give me 100 digits, or so in total. And I said, well, what's the probability of somebody having those 100 digits? It's 1 in 10 to the power 100. So you couldn't possibly exist because, you know, you have all exactly these numbers. Of course, but I chose your numbers. So why did that set of numbers come up? There's nothing special about that set of numbers. What happened was you evolved, social security and cars and telephones evolved and were invented, numbers were assigned, and those happened to be the numbers you got. Yeah, but it's very easy to overestimate how unlikely life is if you start focusing on all the details that happen on this planet. And Jack had a very useful way of distinguishing that. He said, if you look at a living creature, there are two different kinds of features it will have. Universals are features that you would expect to evolve many times in different circumstances because they offer they're very general. Flight is a universal. If you've got an atmosphere, flight. Flight gives the creature all sorts of interesting opportunities you wouldn't get if you stay on the ground. So flight should be a universal. But the details of how this is achieved, such as the exact structure of the wing feathers of a hummingbird, that's a parochial. That's something you would not expect to happen again if evolution were run again or if you were on another planet. So winged creatures, yes. Flying creatures, definitely. They might use something other than wings. Probably not helicopters, but who knows? But precise details of, you know, the wings have to be this particular shape, the bones have to be made of this particular material, the feathers have to be fitted together in precisely this, you know, and the markings on the bird have to be white spots on black or, you know, iridescent blue on the hummingbird or whatever. Those are parochials. Those will be different everywhere. If you ask what does a Martian look like, you can't specify the parochials. You have no idea, but you might be able to specify the universals.
I see. So it's seeing what is universal across many different species.
What's universal? How would, if it's universal, evolution, if it can happen, will tend to focus on that kind of possibility because that's out there in possibility space. It's there. It's waiting. The complexity theorists have this view of things. There is a sort of space of possibilities and we sit in certain locations within it or anything you're interested in is located within it, but it's surrounded by things that could happen. Biological organism is surrounded by all the things that could happen if you slightly mutate the DNA. So this is the possibility space. It's huge.
It's a fun place to be.
Yeah.
Because you can come up with all types of theories and assumptions and perhaps is that where your curiosity comes from? Because I'd love to ask you, you know, one of the things that I'm very interested about is where individuals get their curiosity from. And it seems like you have a curiosity in many different subjects in many different fields. So where does your curiosity in these subjects originate?
I think I've always had it. When I was about 5 years old at school, I got very interested in a number of different things in the encyclopedia that they had in the class, among them astronomy and dinosaurs.
Okay.
No, kids are generally into planets dinosaurs. And dinosaurs, in fact, so there's nothing special about this. I used to listen. There was a radio program on Radio Luxembourg, which was 208 meters. It wasn't the BBC. It wasn't the standard UK. There weren't that many. We're talking 1950 here. I had an old radio set in my bedroom. My parents had given me, and there was a series about Dan Dare, pilot of the future. So this ran in a comic as a colour comic strip every week, okay. But they'd also turned it into a radio program. And I bought the comic and I listened to it. And he has adventures on Mars and Venus and everything else. And it's a thinly disguised version of the Royal Air Force. Okay. It's what the Royal Air Force would be if you put it into space. But this was great fun. There was a... You could get a map of the solar system from this program. But friend and I decided that we couldn't persuade our parents to fork out the money to buy us this map. So we make one of our own. And we started making this space map. And other kids in the class saw this, and what are you doing? And we explained, oh, that's great. You know, we'll make ours. And we're all inventing, you know, put extra planets in that don't exist. It was all very creative and very disorganized. And we had to do these maps on big sheets of paper. So all the kids were doing them on the floor. They wouldn't fit on the desk. And the school inspector came in one day and found the entire class on the floor making these maps. I wonder what the heck was going on. But I think that it was when I was interested in something, I always wanted to take it further, run with it, do something with it. My father, who worked in a bank all his life, he was basically a bank security guard all his life, but he was very good at painting seascapes, and he would do portraits. He was also very practical. He did a lot of woodwork. When he retired, he put central heating in his house himself.
Wow.
He put in the electrical power circuit in the house himself. He wasn't trained in plumbing or electrician, but he found out how to do it. And I think, you know, somebody had to come and inspect the installation and certify it was okay, but it was, and they did. So he was actually quite adaptable to a lot of different activities. And I picked up quite a lot from him. I do paint. I've got a painting going on at the moment upstairs. Nice. Landscape.
What type of painting is it? Watercolor or is it?
I do landscapes. Okay. But I've tried portraits and I'm no good at them, so I've stopped trying that. But landscapes are not too bad. I tend to work from a photograph.
Okay.
So at the moment, we went to Namibia some time ago, and they have fantastic rock formations. And I'm doing a painting of some of the granite formations in Namibia at the moment. We went to India for a tiger safari, and I've got a picture of the tiger hanging on the wall, and so on.
Have you thought about actually commissioning them and sharing them, or is this just something for yourself?
Mostly I do it for myself, and we hang them on the wall, and we're running out of wall space.
But I'm sure your wife loves you. You know, there's 9,000 books around the house.
My wife is amazingly tolerant, and actually she's not artistic, but she likes paintings and various artwork we have around the house. The strange thing about the artwork around our house is most of it is abstract art.
Okay.
And we're not actually much into abstract art. But occasionally you find an artist who kind of grabs you. We were in Hawaii. We were on a round-the-world tour, mostly going to New Zealand, and we went through Maui. And we were staying in Maui for a week, and my wife wanted some prescription snorkel goggles because she needs glasses, and underwater you can't see very well and you can't wear the glasses. And there was a shop in Maui that would do prescription goggles for you, take about 2 hours to put them together. So we went in just before lunch, ordered the goggles, went for lunch, and we still had an hour or so to kill, and there was an art gallery. And we wandered into this art gallery, and it was full of very abstract but rather striking and unusual paintings done by a man called Elan Vital, which has to be a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. Spirit of life. but they were absolutely beautiful. And it turned out he made his own paints from minerals, and he'd bought gallons and gallons and gallons of some very heavy varnish from McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company, which used it to coat the wings of aircraft in the days when they were built that way. And it was as strong as could possibly be. And he would mix his paints with this McDonnell Douglas varnish and just sort of spread them over the surface and see what happened and let it flow and let the chemicals react and get these beautiful, beautiful patterns. And we saw this and we thought, we want one of those. So we have three of his paintings now hanging on the wall.
Oh, wow.
But if you had told us beforehand that we were going to go and buy an abstract painting, we'd say, that's crazy. We don't like that sort of thing. But this one talked to us. We're both interested in ancient Egypt. We're both interested in archaeology in general. We're both interested in geology. We've done amateur classes in these things. Most of that was my wife was interested in those, and we kind of joined forces on them. Mm. But I am a bit of a butterfly brain. I'm what in science fiction circles is called a joat, J-O-A-T, jack of all trades. And in fact, the first science fiction story I sold was about a joat.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, and I think I am one, but I'm not as good as he was.
Well, it's
yeah, so joat is, you know, is you can turn your hand to anything, but also you are kind of interested in almost. I can get myself interested in some in almost anything if I'm talking to somebody who themselves is interested.
Exactly.
I had a fantastic conversation once in Oxford with a medievalist who was an expert on the use of punctuation in medieval writing. And he spent the whole of lunch telling me about the comma in medieval times. And for that lunchtime, it was fascinating.
It's not something you're going to go research afterwards, but it's definitely fascinating.
No, I didn't feel any compulsion to follow up on it.
It's something that I love about speaking with authors on different subjects is, for instance, today we've covered many topics, but then next week I can speak to someone about art history or data or whatever it might be. And I think being interested in other people that are passionate about a subject is fascinating, because you can learn so much if you just listen. Thank you so much, Ian, for coming on the podcast. I mean, we touched upon many things, from your experience with mathematics, your love of science fiction writing. I think it was utterly fascinating to listen to you and your story. One thing I'd just like to finish with is, you know, I think a lot of people have aversions to mathematics. They might have a fear of it. They perhaps are not approaching it the right way. So I'd love for you just to give a couple of tips, or perhaps some words of wisdom for anyone who's looking to become better at mathematics, or just their approach to it.
Okay. I sympathize with people who just don't find it appeals to them, because it is a strange sort of subject. My wife is not a mathematician. We get on fine despite that. But, you know, she has never wanted to share my interest. However, she has found at various times in her nursing career that there were mathematical ideas she needed to know. And at that point, she found it much easier to pick them up. So, she was an eye nurse for some time, and you have to know about a little bit of the mathematics of optics, and you have to know a little bit about probability theory, because the genetics of eye diseases and eye colours and things like that come up. So quite a bit of her school math suddenly became worth understanding, and then she didn't have too much trouble, you know, picking it up. So I think one way of trying to get to grips with math, if you're not very happy with it, is to see if you can find somewhere where it is actually used, and somewhere that is of interest to you. And quite often, you know, the teachers don't have time to tell you this. The syllabus, the school curriculum is prescribed already, and there aren't enough hours in the day to do all this stuff. My preference would be to throw out some of the technical details and spend more time on this sort of, you know, what's it for? What can we do for it? Can we have fun with this? Can you approach it? It's easy to say, don't be scared. It's much harder to not be scared. Mm. But if you get a mathematical idea in your head and you do understand it, most people then find it makes a lot of sense, and everything that follows from it is much easier. In fact, people, if they have an original mathematical idea, it may not be original in the math community, but original to them, this is often a high point of their their week, of their month, of their existence. They're really quite pleased that they've had this mathematical insight. So we all start out as kids interested in patterns and shapes and numbers and things. Most kids are interested in them. And then at some point, we start to lose that interest. I think the ones who become mathematicians are the ones who don't. If you lose interest, it may be just because other things, you know, football, whatever, suddenly becomes much more important to you. A lot of it is that the way it's taught in schools, and I'm not blaming the teachers, emphasizes getting the answer right and lots of detail and a certain amount of, not so much nowadays, but it used to be a lot of memory as well. And this is very off-putting. I would go and do some, read Martin Gardner's books, get off the school syllabus altogether, read some popular maths books, read some of the, I mean, the Martin Gardner ones are lovely because they're a sort of mixture of puzzles and games and other things. And you read this, and, hey, this is great, this is really interesting, and maybe there's a model for you to build or something like that. And after you've done that, about 6 months later, you think, I actually learned some math from that. So, you know, there's a lot online, there's a lot of things you can find now to help. Don't let the way you have been taught math put you off it.
I think that's an interesting point because I have been reading a lot about, from school, then I studied politics, but then I turned into software development and I've started to learn a lot more about algorithms and data structures. And it's building upon the things I learned at school, but now there's a reason to do so. There's an interest, there's a reason, like you said, to study it further because there's that curiosity there, which has opened me up to a new world of the way to see things and to see maths. It's been quite fascinating for me personally, so I definitely agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, the other point that comes out of that is what schools are trying to do, that they can't tailor the course to each individual. What they're trying to do is equip everybody with a lot of basic stuff, some of which could be useful for them in a future career. A lot of future careers would be impossible for them if they didn't have that background. It doesn't mean they're going to use it, but it means if they haven't got it, then they're handicapped in what they can do. In fact, my answer often to parents who say, why is my kid being asked to do this at school? I say, well, look, suppose I came up to you and said, now, Mrs. Smith, your child doesn't need to do maths at school at all. You know, we're perfectly happy. She can do something else. He can do something else. But I tell you now, they will never be able to be an airline pilot, a surgeon. They won't be able to work in a bank anywhere other than at the lowest level. They couldn't possibly be a doctor. They couldn't be a lawyer. They couldn't be. I will tell you all of the things that your child will not be able to be. You are just condemning them to menial jobs. And that might be what they want. They might be happy. That's fine. But this, understand, this is what you're saying if you think they should just be let off doing math because they don't like it.
I think that's a great place to end it because I think it's interesting that most people have this aversion to it, but I think if you make it specific and you make it something that's interesting to you, I think it's something that can lead you into different fields like it has done for you and keep you curious, which is the main thing. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Ian. I think it's fascinating, your story and your passion for many different subjects is infectious, and hopefully it's inspired many people who are listening to this to go and explore different fields as well and be their own type of butterfly into those types of stuff. So before we end, where's the best places that individuals can find you, whether it be a website or on social media?
Okay, so I have a website. That's the best way to find out about me, about everything, and get into various bits of math that are around. So it's ianstewartjote.weebly.com.
Perfect. I'll put the link in the description below so everyone can go check that out and go have a look at all the wonderful books that you've written. The most recent one being What's the Use? The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, which is this one right here. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Ian. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Owen. It was great fun. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to take part.
You're welcome. Take care.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Hopefully you found some interesting insights and was inspired creatively. I know I was after speaking with Ian, being so passionate about the mathematics and being so technically minded, but also having a flair for fantasy fiction and writing as well. For someone like me who likes to think of himself as doing many different things, you can be inspired by his story. So I definitely recommend checking out his work and reading his book, but also thinking about how you can diversify yourself and thinking about how you can do multiple things in different fields and not putting yourself into a box. Like I said, if you haven't already, please do subscribe to the podcast. Every single week we release a podcast with an author to discuss their books and the ideas and principles inside of it. The best way to do that is subscribe over at our YouTube channel at Book Talk Today. That is the best way that you can support this channel to get the message out there. Thank you so much again for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode.